I'm very grateful for the invitation to be here and to talk to you and to learn from you from your presentations over the course of the day. So thank you for that. That's much appreciated. So I'm going to talk about the notion of terrain, which is the best concept that I've so far found to make sense of what I'm going to call the political materiality of territory. And I'm going to try and explain why I've come to this and what I'm trying to do with this work and connect to some other people who I think are doing work in a related way to this. And what I'm going to say today, the most detailed explanation of it is in a piece that has just been published that was given as the London Review of International Law lecture earlier this year and has just gone online in the advanced section of that journal. So pretty much everything today is going to be drawing on that paper. Now, I've worked on the question of territory for a number of years, and I keep thinking I'm done with this, and then I kind of come up with a different way, at least for me, to think about the questions around territory. So far, it's led to two books. One is a very, at the time, was a very contemporary book, a very political book, on the War on Terror, which was really my best answer to a question I always got when I worked on territory, was all this stuff on the Middle Ages is all very well, but how does this relate to anything going on in the world today? So an article which was to try to make sense of the War on Terror, which then became a sequence of articles and became the book. And then when I'd finished that, I said, right, now I'm going to go back to the history of political thought work and think through the question of territory in the way that I'd always intended to, which led to that second book, The Birth of Territory. Now, what I try to do in those books, among other things, is to say that territory is not a simple concept. People have tended to, particularly I think in political geography, international relations, to think that territory is a relatively straightforward concept that is always complicated in practice. And my suggestion is to say, yes, it's absolutely complicated in practice, but part of the reason is that territory is a complicated concept, that it's not simply the straightforward definition that you always get, that territory is a bounded space under the control of a group of people, perhaps a state. Territory actually includes a whole range of different relations, and it seemed to me to make sense to interrogate those different relations or the different registers of the question of territory in order to grasp the complexity of it as a concept and then as a practice and the relation between those. So in these books, what I suggest is that rather than being simply a political and a geographical idea, territory is also something that we should interrogate through the economic and the strategic, which I think are fairly well established, the way that you might think of a political economy of territory, of property and land, of economic relations, or the strategic through warfare, through securitization and so on. But to take much more seriously the legal, what legal codes and norms apply and where do they cease to apply and how do they dictate the very extent of their jurisdiction as much as the legislation about what they allow and don't allow, but also to take very seriously the notion of the technical. How do developments in geometry, in land surveying, in cartography, in census, in particularly the 16th and 17th century, how do these transform the way that we think about territory? And then we could bring it up to the present. How are technologies developing today that are also transforming how we think about those kinds of relations? Now, in the book that was mentioned in the introduction, my next book on territory, which is a book really about Shakespeare, it's not just using Shakespeare as a quick way into these questions, but it's intended to be an interrogation of Shakespeare's plays at a level that I would hope that literary theory would find of interest. But what I do with this is to provide readings of a large number of Shakespeare's plays, mainly the tragedies and the histories, but also a few of the comedies. And I do this in order to examine these different aspects of the question of territory. Some of them are ones that I've already talked about in previous works, where I use Richard II to talk about the economic, property and land, rent, these kinds of questions, or the beginning of Henry V to talk about legal questions in relation to land. But I also pick up on themes that I know that I've neglected in previous work and that people have not been slow to suggest that I've neglected in previous work. So I talk about the colonial, and I do that through a reading, obviously, of The Tempest, but a number of other Shakespeare plays set in the Eastern Mediterranean. I do a reading of particularly Coriolanus to think about the corporeal, the bodies in territories and territories as bodies and the relation between these. But I also talk about what I'm calling the geophysical. And it's the geophysical that I'm going to spend my time today talking to you about, and the relation between the geophysical and the geopolitical. In this book, I do it through a reading of the first part of Henry IV, where there's a discussion between three people about how they're going to apportion the land of the kingdom. And one of them objects to the fact that the river that forms the southern boundary of his share of land, the river for him is in the wrong place, because it doesn't give him the equitable distribution of land that he thinks. So rather than drawing a new line on the map, they actually suggest changing the course of the river so that it runs in a better channel, fair and evenly, to distribute the land. So I'd use that as a way of starting to think about the geophysical. And really, I keep coming back to this quotation in a piece that Neil Brenner and I wrote when we were first working on the question of territory. And I keep coming back to this quotation because for me, it really opens up the problematic that I've been trying to work through in all of these works. It's that territory precedes any kind of human or social interaction and conditions that interaction, even as it is continually shaped and reshaped by those interactions. That it's not there as something that is an inert product that is there and then politics happens within that territorial frame. Territory is made and remade, a continual process of making and remaking, but it's not something that is entirely malleable. It's the relation between this. And so Neil and I in that piece, and we end up riffing on Marx, that states make their own territories, but not under circumstances they have chosen, but under the given and inherited circumstances with which they are confronted. So it's that continual making and remaking of territory as a process rather than a product that much of my work has been concerned with. Now, when we think about the material in relation to territory, and we think about, for example, borders, which are the most obvious immediate thing that people think about. For me, the territory question extends far beyond simply the borders of the state, but to take that as an example immediately, people would often think about the materiality through things like the stones or the fences or the ditches, the roads, the cleared vistas, the very physical built landscape that is at boundaries that marks out the jurisdiction between two political legal regimes. But also historically, there's been quite a lot of work around what is sometimes called natural borders or natural boundaries. And France is the classic example of this, the suggestion that was made in the 17th century and beyond, that France had natural boundaries, which were the English Channel, the Atlantic, the Pyrenees, the Mediterranean, the Alps, and the Rhine River, and that France should extend to those boundaries, but not beyond those boundaries. Now, there's nothing inherently natural about these natural boundaries other than the fact that they use geophysical features to mark them. I always talk with my students about the arbitrary nature of this. If you're going to go through a mountain range, why do you choose these peaks to link in a line rather than those peaks? If you're going to use seas, why do some seas become boundaries, but why does France later make claims to Algeria on the southern bank of the Mediterranean? Why the Rhine River as an important political boundary and not the Rhone River? So there's a necessary arbitrariness to it, but there's also a technology to surveying and to marking out the boundaries in these places. If you look at the Pyrenees, for example, as the boundary between France and Spain, decided that it would be the boundary in the Treaty of the Pyrenees in 1659, but it takes a long time for the technology to get to the point where they can accurately survey this and mark this out in terms of the physical landscape. So with the boundary as one example, I'm interested in that relation between the geopolitical and the geophysical, between the political legal regimes and the relation to the built and the so-called natural environment. Now, I can't kind of fail to use this as a quick example, the Trump Wall, and these are some of the prototypes that have been produced. Here are the eight that they've produced, these small sections of the wall as an example. And this is the International Business Times description around this, about various types of physical durability, of aesthetic from the US side, they don't care about the Mexico side. Also about visibility, about the way to control or to direct movement. And so on. Now, what's interesting about this, I think, is that the suggestion is often, you know, about this being put there because there isn't something sufficient. But the last time I was at the boundary, there is already a feature that is there in the landscape. And what I'm interested in these slides is just the interaction between the built and the geophysical landscape in these. You can see, and nearly all of these photos are taken from exactly the same point, but just pointing the camera in different directions. You can see what appears to be a fence that is extending far into the distance across the landscape, with the roads to one side of it as a route of maintenance and control and securitization alongside it. And you can see that it is there to prevent some movement, but not all movement, that this would allow small animals to be able to get through, for example. It also allows the visibility that is one of the criteria for the new wall. But if you turn 90 degrees again, then you see that the wall actually stops, and that they use a different kind of barrier, which would prevent movement of vehicles. And given the nature of what I would call the terrain in this place, if you didn't have a vehicle to move, then you wouldn't actually get very far in this landscape. So they can use these anti-vehicle measures to stop the movement through there. And they're using the physicality of the landscape, the fact that this is a desert region, the fact of the limited access points, the lack of water, the lack of safety in this region, to mean that the physical landscape forms part of the boundary as much as the built part of the landscape at that point. And I think you could say something similar about the way that Europe is using the Mediterranean, the physicality of the Mediterranean Sea as part of its boundary with the migrants that are coming in from both North Africa and from the Middle East. So some of the issues that I'm working through in this work are collaborative. They're with a project that's run by Phil Steinberg at Durham University in the International Boundary Research Unit. And it's a project that's funded by the Leverhulme Trust to look at what is called ice law. Now, when this project was first started, the idea was that Phil's suggestion was that just as we have legal codes that pertain to territory on land, we also have legal codes that pertain to territory at sea, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. What about ice? And Phil's suggestion was that ice, which blurs geophysical form, also complicates geopolitical regime, that it can be solid at some times of the year and it can melt at other times of the year. And particularly with anthropogenic climate change, this is becoming ever more important. There are a number of issues that are being exacerbated by sea ice that was there, or used to be there at least permanently, or is there seasonally, is now becoming navigable passages. So you can go north over Canada, the fabled Northwest Passage has become available. So this opens up various types of political legal questions. Now, in our initial discussions about a law of ice, we said, well, actually, this geophysical relation to the geopolitical also complicates things in other places other than the high Arctic or the Antarctic. And that if you look at, for example, river deltas or mangrove swamps or coastlines more generally, if you look at river boundaries, if you look at desert regions, a number of these geophysical features, as well as glaciers, so ice that is not sea ice, these are complicated by various processes that complicate not just the geophysical form, but also the geopolitical regimes. So Phil, in a burst of inspiration, decided that ice law was both ice law and a specific idea of law of ice, but it was also an acronym. And the first part of which I think is brilliant, indeterminate and changing environments. And the second part is law of the Anthropocene in the world. I'm less sold on the second part, but I think indeterminate and changing environments is exactly what we're trying to get at with this work around these issues. And a map that the Boundary Research Unit at Durham produced a few years ago of the Arctic and showing the overlapping claims around it from the Arctic states about how you might actually demarcate both the ice, the water, the seabed as well, and the mineral resources, the drilling rights and so on. This, for me, exemplifies those kinds of issues that I've talked about in my work on territory before, the economic, the strategic, the legal and the technical, because so much of the work that's being done by Denmark and the US and Canada and Russia and so on is inherently technical in terms of the surveying that they are trying to do in order to make claims to extension of the continental shelf, of the physical features on the seabed, of the durability of sea ice, the density, and so on. So there's a whole technical aspect to the politics in this. But of course, there's this material aspect, which is one of the things I said that I'd neglected in my previous work, the geophysical coming in around that. So in various pieces, I've been trying to think about this physical nature, the geophysical alongside the geopolitical. This is a photo I took a few years ago in a trip I took with Chaim Jacobi, who some of you may know, who's in part, at least part of the Bartlett School here. Heim took me to this iconic view of a road that you can see, which is on elevated platforms, above another road which snakes through the landscape on the ground floor. The road on the elevated platform is an Israeli settler road to link Israeli settlements in the West Bank to Jerusalem. The road on the surface is a Palestinian road that links Palestinian villages in the same landscape. So there's a physicality to this landscape, a materiality to this landscape, which is related to the complications of the geopolitical regimes in there. Now, other people have got here and thought about this work. Many of you will know the work of Eyal Weissman, an Israeli architect who now teaches at Goldsmiths and runs the forensic architecture project there. And Eyal uses that same view on the cover of his book, Hollow Land. And he's talking about how if we're going to try and grasp the politics of this and the materiality, we need to go beyond simply a simple cartographic representation of two dimensions. We need to think this through in relation to the three dimensions, the vertical, both above the surface and below the surface. And so some of my work has been concerned with thinking about some of those issues. Another person, a former colleague of mine, Stephen Graham, has also done work, which I guess many of you will be familiar with, about how cities work, how cities are destroyed, and then particularly this vertical dimension in his most recent book around that. And while I find their work incredibly useful and valuable and draw on it enormously in my own work, the thing that I want to maybe add beyond what they're doing is to put more emphasis on the geophysical rather than simply the built environment. So it's the relation for me of the built environment to the physical landscape and the continual interaction of those things. I think it's there in their work, but I think it might be pushed a little bit further in those terms. And the key person I'm really in dialogue with around the notion of terrain as the best concept that I think we've got to make sense of these kinds of questions is an anthropologist, Gaston Gordillo, who's at University of British Columbia, who's written some very interesting books, many drawing on fieldwork in Argentina, but the most recent of which is Rubble, The Afterlife of Destruction, with Duke University Press in 2014. And his suggestion, which I think I broadly agree with, is that terrain is this concept that helps us to get at some of this physical materiality of space, what he calls the material forms, volumes, and textures. And it's the interaction of what's there in the physical landscape and the transformation that human social agency can make to that, and then the transformation that creates for the next iteration of those kinds of relations. And I think this sort of division of labour between us is Gaston seems to me to be more interested in terrain in itself. I'm more interested in terrain as a way to make sense of the materiality of territory, to add into this work that I've been doing and to build on it, but to force me to take the geophysical much more seriously in that work. So really just to end then, the way that I'm trying to think about terrain is not just solid land. Terrain has often been associated just with land. There's a distinction between topography and bathymetry in terms of the surveying of the surface. But it seems to me there's no necessarily good reason why we should treat the things that need to be surveyed differently if they are underwater than if they are under air. It seems to me that there is a relation between those that I think that the notion of terrain, which can mean earth in the planetary sense as well as earth in the dry land sense. So terrain seems to me to be able to get at some of those questions, to make sense of things like deserts, glaciers, and there's a whole range of projects that people are doing that I think can inform this kind of work. It's to try and think about what I'm calling the geophysics of geopolitics, although physical geographers sometimes balk at that because for them geophysics has quite a particular technical sense, but it's a way of trying to grasp the geophysical and the geopolitical together and the relation between those. And that stress, which I suspect many of the papers today will also make this same kind of argument, it's that relation of the built and the physical landscape and the interrelation between the two that's so important. Thank you.